This time on the Plutopia podcast, Alan Chamberlain explains his music and his journey to recovery. We explore country music, songwriting, the power of music in recovery, and the 12-step process.
I traveled around a lot in my early years. I set out to become the next Bob Dylan, you know, and discovered that that job was already taken. But I traveled around the Southwest, I traveled around the Southeast. I come from mid-Missouri, and found that I could generally find employment as a singing cowboy in medium-sized college towns as a new kid in town. And so I'd get 3 to 6 months before I'd stop being the new kid in town, before I'd then move on to another town. And that was kind of how I developed my persona and my style and all of that.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the very exciting Plutopia News Network podcast. Today, our guest is Alan Chamberlain, also known as Axon. Singer-songwriter in the urban cowboy tradition, and that's urban spelled H-E-R-B-A-N, so think about it. His songwriting examines the Western mythos in defiance of the popular image created by an atavistic mass media. Boy, you can say that again. He says, I've learned from studying songwriters like Guy Clark, John Prine, Nancy Griffith, and James McMurtry. These are all people we know real well in Austin.
I'll bet. But
he said he's learned that if you're going to write a multi-generational novel in 3 choruses and a bridge, you're going to have to make a lot of shit up and leave a lot of shit out. Alan and I met online about 3 decades ago, I think, and we've been virtual friends ever since, and we're just happy to have him on board. He is Axon Songs on YouTube, by the way. You can find him there, and we find him here, too. Hello.
Hi.
And I'm How also are you?
SoundCloud and everywhere music is just given away.
Oh, that's right. SoundCloud. I don't know why I neglected that.
Yeah. The better
all over the place. We'll put it at Plutopia.io where the primary version of this recording will go. We'll post a bunch of links.
Okay.
So people will have no trouble finding you.
Awesome.
So, just launching into it, it's like when you do songwriting, what are your themes really? And are you writing, do you consider this folk music, country music, Americana?
Well, I call it Western music. It's like country music, but you're never going to hear it on country radio. I think most radio micro format programmers would call it Americana. I think the difference is that country music is kind of about the same things that pop music is about. Romance, disappointments of that kind and that sort of thing. Whereas Americana is about people's lives and where they live and how they live.
The way I always thought about it was that country music is about the person in the bar with their head down, sort of sobbing, and Americana is about somebody in a bar dancing. You remember there was a magazine called No Depression, and it was about like country music that wasn't about the worst of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good analysis as well.
Yeah, I noticed from the days when I was producing country concerts in the West Coast that all the country musicians, so-called country musicians, were all ex-rock and roll musicians who just needed a gig. And at that point, country was making more money than rock was.
It kind of reminds me of a story. I was playing a gig and a guy came up to me after the show and said, you know, I want to be a really good country guitar player. What do you recommend I do in order to become a good country guitar player? I said, well, the first thing you got to do is become a good jazz guitar player. It wasn't the answer he wanted to hear.
Why a jazz guitar player?
Because you really need to know the theory to play country well. Anybody can play, and I mean, someone who's been playing guitar for 6 months can play country songs with the G, C, D, 1-4-5 format, and that's fine. And they strum, you know. But the kind of music I play and the kind of music I like to play is a lot more, it's a lot more interpolation happening musically. And even though it's in major keys, and it isn't using a lot of, you know, exotic chord voicings, it nevertheless, there's phrasing, there's rhythm, there's all these things you really need to have under your fingers in order to be able to sell it. And most of the best country players I've ever met were all really good jazz guitarists as well.
So I wonder, when you're writing a song, which comes first, words or music?
You know, every song is different. Every songwriter is different and every song is different. And what they have in common is that each one has its own demands. I've got a song I wrote all of the lyrics to in one setting. All I had was an opening line. I thought, oh, that'd make a good opening line for a song. And I went into my stranded lyrics file and I typed it out. And as soon as I got to the end of that line, the next line came to me. And this went on for 20 minutes, 16 lines. Just bang, 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 bang. It was like taking dictation from the muse. And I didn't write the music for it for months. I was working on an entirely different idea, and I was working on some changes that I really liked, but they weren't flowing the way I wanted it to progress. And so I tried it in another time signature and it just clicked. And I realized, oh, that's the rhythm bed for that other song, for those lyrics. So it happens like that. Now, the same time that I wrote all those lyrics down, I was also fooling around with some changes that I'd kind of lifted from U2. They'd been on the Grammys that year. They played a song called Get Out of Your Own Way. And I thought, well, that's an interesting progression. And I started fooling around with it. And it doesn't take very long before it doesn't sound at all like the song that I took them from. And I had all that. And I really liked playing it. I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to play, to the point where I was working out all the little fiddly bits between the chorus and the bridge. And I had the beginning and the ending and the whole thing, all the music written out, not a single word, didn't have any idea what it was going to be about. And then that Valentine's Day was the shooting at Parkland High School. And that's what that song is about. And those lyrics came to me again, like dictation. I've got a song, and you can find it on my YouTube channel. It's kind of my headline tune on my YouTube channel. It's called Between the River and the Rails. And that was a song of craft. I had an idea about what I wanted to try and say, what I wanted it to be about. And I had to do a lot of heavy lifting. It took months. I went through two completely different sets of changes, two completely different sets of lyrics before I finally got it all nailed down. The next day, another song came through, boom, complete. The chords, the lyrics, everything. I wrote the whole thing in an hour. It's probably even a better song. So it can happen. It can happen anyway.
So when you play a set, like when you're playing a live set or when you're playing a whole set for like YouTube or whatever, do you follow a particular sequence or pattern and like in the way that you sequence the songs?
I do. Actually, it was funny. I saw McMurtry here last November and he was playing and people kept yelling out requests. And he finally stopped and he looked and said, look, a lot of you seem to know what you want to hear, but not one of you knows what you're gonna hear. I've been doing this live performing thing for about 30 years. And I think I'm starting to get pretty good at figuring out what I'm gonna play. And then he went in and he played all the hits and everybody was happy. I mean, it was, but yeah, I try to follow a kind of a hero's journey model where the opening couple of two or three songs is really enrollment. Hey, come along with me. We're going to go on a trip together. We're going to have some fun. Hey, right. And then songs about places and the people that live there, because, you know, when you go on a trip, you meet people, you go interesting places and you meet interesting people. So we're going to do that. So we play some songs that showcase locales and the folks that are living there. And over the course of it, the theme gets darker and darker, right? Songs about addiction, songs about suicide, songs that make us examine our own mortality. And in the hero's journey, the hero experiences his own death or a simulacrum of it, and then is redeemed by some act of virtue. Well, that's when I switched to a redemptive ballad, and everybody feels so good, right? Because that's they've gone through this experience, and now they feel rebalanced, as it were. And at that point, you can play anything you want. You've got them in the palm of your hands, and that's when I usually turn to more up-tempo tunes to round out, you know, and take it home, as it were, at the end of the set. Now, my opening song is pretty much the same any place I've never played before. My first song is going to be this one. And this is, as I introduce it this way, this is a bit of advice. I can't promise that it's sound advice, but there's wisdom in it. And you young people should pay attention to this, because smart people learn from their mistakes. Wise people learn from my mistakes. You can't be too careful, safety first, that's what they say. But so much temptation can come your way. Adventures beckon and you sure wanna go. Well, baby, ain't but one way to know. What doesn't kill you makes you strong. What kills you dead. Don't regret what you didn't do, what you didn't say. Step right up, seize the day, light the fuse and get away. You never know till you try. Start, don't know just what you do. You see those eyes across the crowded room and they're looking back at you. Ain't no time to think about it. You make your move and you make it count. They say timing is everything, but there ain't no time like now. What doesn't kill you makes you strong. What kills you dead. Don't regret what you didn't do, what you didn't say. Step right up, seize the day, light the fuse and get away. You never know till you try. Oh, you only go around once in life, so grab all you hold in. When you're out of dust, oh, well, maybe you are out of here. Carpe diem, et memento mori. Opportunity knocks just once, so you better get the door. What doesn't kill you makes you strong. What kills you dead. You don't regret what you didn't do, what you did instead. Step right up, seize the day, light the fuse and get away. You never know. Don't miss the show now, baby. You never know. Just do it. You never know till you try. You know you only live once. You never know till you try. Baby, you're worth it. You never know till you try.
Oh, great stuff.
Thank you. And so with that approach to life, it's probably not a surprise that I'm in recovery. And that's really informed a lot of my...
started today, we're setting up. You told me some of your heroic journey that you've been through. Can you go back and relive a little of that? You didn't just pop up unannounced. There was some travel.
Fully formed.
Well, I did. I traveled around a lot in my early years. I set out to become the next Bob Dylan, you know, and discovered that job was already taken. But I traveled around the Southwest. I traveled around the Southeast. I come from mid-Missouri, and found that I could generally find employment as a singing cowboy in medium-sized college towns as a new kid in town. And so I'd get 3 to 6 months before I'd stop being the new kid in town, before I'd then move on to another town. And that was kind of how I developed my persona and my style and all of that. From going from, you know, cafes and honky tonks and bars all over the country. Like I was saying, I 10 years ago, I got sober. I had quit playing music I had a CMC joint blowout in my left hand, and so I couldn't play anymore. And so I sold off all my guitars and was able to finally make the pivot from a high functioning alcoholic to a raging alcoholic. And I spent 3 years finding the bottom of that, and then another 3 years in the program, as they say, finding my way back to the edge of the cliff I fell off of. And I had to start playing music again to really get happy sober. And some of you have probably heard of David Wilcox. He's a singer-songwriter. He had written a song that I had learned back in the day, and I started trying to play it again after I got sober. And I realized that there was a hidden Easter egg in that tune about sobriety. And it dawned on me, this is how he's doing his 12th step, which basically boils down to help others. And it's the only step you can do out of order. So I figured it's probably the only one that works. It's the only one I've done. And this is how I'm doing my 12th step, as I've got songs that communicate hope, strength, and experience to others who may need to hear that message. And this is why I play in honky tonks and bars, because you got to put the hay down where the goats can get at it, right? You're not going to win a whole lot of converts in church. So anyway, so this is, and the problem, see, the hardest part about recovery is not, you know, the self-denial and the cravings and the meetings, good God, the meetings. The hardest part about recovery is that there aren't any really good, rowdy, not drinking songs. So I had to remedy that deficit in the repertoire with this tune. Yeah.
There's something about the way she makes my day, but only my baby gets me high. So I was talking to my doctor about my shoulder. He says, you have a muscle strain. Take two of these anytime you please. You won't be feeling any pain. I said, now what about massage or some yoga? There's some herbs I know relax the spine. The natural touch can do so much. I'm already doing pretty damn fine. I don't want to feel any better than the way I feel right now. The sky is blue here with you, and I don't see why anything could make me feel better. So I ain't even gonna try. There's something about the way she makes my day, but only my baby gets me high. I was talking to a suit from the label in the green room just before the show. He offered me a line of the very finest pharmaceutical for frame and blow. I said, my policy has always been the same. I'll do every last bit of yours, but I gotta be sad to feel that bad, and I just can't take it anymore. Later at the after party, everybody wanna buy me get shots. Everybody's asking, what are you drinking? What I'm drinking is not. Cause when I get home to my baby, this is just the way I want to be. Cause nothing can make me feel better than the way my baby loves me. So I don't want to feel any better. I'm already doing cartwheels now. The sky is blue. I'm still here with you, and I don't see why or how anything could make me feel better. Well, maybe just a slice of that pie. Something about the way she makes my day. Oh, when my baby gets me high. Something about the way she makes my day. Oh, when my baby gets me high. I'll try some of that sativa, but I ain't gonna leave her. Only my baby gets me high.
This is my faux blues tune. Red wine, get it on out of here. Unless you're talking about love, I've had enough. Now you can keep your cocaine. Don't need no medicine to cure my ills or pay your bills. Unless you're talking about love, I've had enough. Can't tempt me with riches sufficient to the day. Is the evil whereof more you scratch it, more it itches. The only sure cure. So you can keep your silver and all your gold. There ain't nothing of lasting value to be found in this wicked world, so I'm told. Unless you're talking about love, I've had enough. Don't need material stuff unless you're talking about love.
Nice.
And those are the kind of songs that at the end of the show, someone comes up and goes, you know, I heard what you were singing about recovery. I'd like to learn more.
Did your songwriting change markedly in recovery?
A lot. It got good. I mean, the thing about addiction, and it doesn't matter whether it's addiction to a substance or to a behavior or what have you. It's a coping mechanism for treating early trauma, generally speaking. Some people, late trauma, they've got PTSD, real PTSD. But like 40% of adults are thought to have some form of this adverse childhood experience that burdens them. And if you don't confront it and deal with it and resolve it, and you never fully resolve it, but if you don't work it, you're going to be easily seduced by substances and behaviors that make you feel good. It's comfort seeking is all it is. It's ritualized compulsive comfort seeking, whether it's shopping or sex or gambling or what have you. It's all about treating that pain. And just for me, just confronting that pain and recognizing that that was something that happened to me, that something I had suppressed all my life, made it possible. I'm not thirsty at all anymore. I just don't have any interest in feeling like that because I feel, like I said, I'm already doing cartwheels now. So when I started writing songs, and again, I was inspired by David Wilcox's example. The very first song I wrote was a song about seeking comfort. And interestingly enough, I'm curating a program we're going to be putting on July 8th here in Eugene at a community center called Alluvium. There's five artists, including myself, that are going to perform. And they're all people who've got songs with a perspective on recovery. And I'm calling it One Song at a Time, The Power of Music in Recovery. Because it's such a useful mechanism for safely entertaining some scary stuff that you've got buried, you know. It helps you find that stuff and get it out. I'm mostly going to do originals today, but do you mind if I did that David Wilcox tune? Do we have copyright issues or anything?
Actually, there might be a copyright issue. What do you think, Scoop?
YouTube especially, evil programming recognizes the tune, they can flag you.
Yeah, copyright rears its ugly head from time to time.
But your personal
The only time I've ever had that happen with me is when I did the Beatles song.
Yeah, that will definitely get a Bob Dylan song will get you just dinged because we made that mistake early on and got seriously dinged by YouTube.
Okay, so we'll skip
but your
that
stuff one. Is perfectly fine.
Okay, yeah, it's not even so. So anyway, we can chat a little bit about where that took me.
Well, I was going to ask, did you start confronting the pain, whatever experience it was, and then stop drinking as a result? Or did you stop drinking and then find you could confront the pain?
The latter. I had to get sober, and I did. And I went to a meeting every day for 3 years. And I'm an atheist, so it was a big lift. Because they're very, very faith centered.
Understood. Yeah.
My relationship to AA and 12 step is very, complicated. If someone called me right now and said, Alan, I got to get sober. I can't do it on my own. I'm really in trouble. I would go and get them and I would take them to the next meeting. But on the way, I would say, you know, there's the thing you got to understand about 12 step is it's really three steps. It's get in, get what you need, and get out. Because if you stay in there long enough, you're going to hear old timers who've been in there for 20 or 25 years going to meetings at least weekly and sometimes every day. And their narrative is all about how they're just scared to death of the relapse that they know is coming for them. Those people aren't sober. They're addicted to meetings.
Dry drunks.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Here's what 12-step does right. It gives unconditional fellowship. I don't care how bad you screwed up. I screwed up worse. I told my bottom story to my sponsor and he goes, oh, hell, I burned a house down. Right.
Wow.
It's almost competitive. And, but that's something that is part, I mean, that's a critical part of early trauma is you don't have unconditional acceptance. You're not getting unconditional love, right? Everything's transactional. The other thing it does is it gives you a hopeful narrative. Look at all these people that's helped and we can do this together. And that's the third part is the shared purpose. You don't have to do it yourself. You don't have to carry the whole load yourself. Those three things combined, any enterprise that's got those three things has a very high likelihood of success. So, like I said, I went through 3 years of that and went, well, okay, but is this it? Is this as good as it gets? Because I wasn't feeling good. I was just feeling not impaired. And like I said, I was listening to music, listening to that David Wilcox song, which is, by the way, called Slipping Through My Fist, if you want to track it down. And I've got a version of that on my SoundCloud. You know, the story is about how it sounds like a You Only Live Once song. He's talking about, you know, being in a sailboat and letting go of the ropes and just going where the wind takes him. And then the next verse is about the river, you know, it's downhill all the way to the ocean and the river always wants to flow and knows where to go. And, you know, and, but then the chorus is, is all about, how could I have done this? How could I have just let go? And then the third verse, he's talking about returning home. He says, this is where I played as a baby. This is where I ran as a child. This is where my dad took the last breath he had and smiled. And I realized, oh, he went home for his dad's funeral, hooked up with his old posse, and they started doing lines. And the what strange breezes makes a sailor let it come to this with lines untied slipping through my fist is what was I thinking, right? That's what he's saying there. And that's, and I didn't get that the first time I heard that song. I just heard the You Only Live Once element. And then when I heard it in recovery, I went, oh, this is how he's helping others. And I can do the same thing. So it's really been, that's really been a fulcrum of my songwriting. I don't set out to write what I call a 12th step song. I write songs on a whole bunch of different subjects. But it was funny. This is the song that came through to me the day after I had finished Between the River and the Rails. It just came to me and I wrote it. And the first two verses sounded like a You Only Live Once song. And then I got to the bridge and it took a turn on me. And it became a 12th step song. So to a certain degree, I'm taking dictation, but I've opened the channel, you know, so I can hear that voice.
I'm pondering that. I saw a film just last night. It was a film that came out last year. It was called To Leslie. It has Andrea Riseborough in it, and it's a very powerful recovery film. And so I'm thinking about that while you're talking, and I'm just thinking about how difficult it is and how far you have to fall before you really start to climb back up. And I don't know exactly what my point is there, except that I think it's great that you got through recovery and that you also got through AA and sort of like were able to put that aside too, because I think some people exchange their attachment to alcohol for their attachment to AA and, you know, all the coffee and cigarettes and talk that you have at AA. And, you know, the fellowship part is great. But the idea that I knew people who were in recovery and who said that really nobody is okay unless they've done the 12 steps, unless they go through a 12-step program, unless they go through AA. So they were convinced, they were sort of like, you know, you get this from Christians sometime that they believe that unless you're saved, in however they define being saved, that you're sort of like not completely human, I guess. And I think that the real recovery is when you can be 100% who you are and not need anything, you know, to hold you up, that you can hold yourself up.
Well, I had, you know, when I first got into the program, they said, well, now you got to have a higher power. So what's your higher power? And I said, well, music is my higher power. And they said, no, can't be music. And I thought, why not? And they said, it can be anything. It can be a God of your understanding, whatever. I said, well, that's a pretty high power for me. And I fought with them over it for years.
But I would have told him John Coltrane.
Well, I was listening to a lot of Coltrane, and I went to some meditation meetings where it was a fairly progressive group, and they didn't get bogged down too much in the orthodoxy. But then they'd have a 20-minute meditation period, and everyone would obediently sit in a circle and cross their legs and, you know, do their little hand signals and so forth. And I put my headphones on and I would listen to A Love Supreme. And when I had my recording studio in Chico for 10 years, pretty much every single day began with me dropping the needle on side one of A Love Supreme. So it is a very, very powerful thing. It's a carrier signal for something that's much, not just bigger than us. It's bigger than Earth. It's bigger than our solar system. It's bigger than our galaxy. This is something that it just exists in the universe, is music.
I have to agree with you on the Coltrane. I do that quite often with that very vinyl record that I have here. I picked up the new vinyl release of it because I wore out the old stuff. I you know, worked with so many musicians, you know, managing bands and stuff back in the day. And the one thing the two things I found that could easily break up a band was too much alcohol and too much drugs, or actually drugs and alcohol, period. And the people who overcame that actually made better music. And I was impressed by that, but also depressed, because a lot of great musicians that I worked with became not so great as their addictions got worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't make you a better musician. What it can do is it can lower your inhibitions to trying something new and learning new music and appreciating new music. I mean, it's not an unalloyed good by any means, but it can help some musicians get out of their anxieties about playing in front of people and things like that. And because it works, I mean, it works every time. It becomes what they do when they can't get that hit from a live audience. That's a very powerful thing. When you play in front of a live audience and they give you that feedback, that's just the most exhilarating feeling that there is. And then you go back to the hotel and you don't have that feeling anymore, but you've got these lines you can do, you know, and that's kind of, I've seen it happen a lot.
Are you a traveling musician, or are you mostly just playing around Eugene?
Well, I don't tour as such. I did just recently go back to Chico for a week and played four gigs in that week while I was down there. And most of the gigs I do are out of town. I've got a fairly regular appearance over on the coast. And I kind of seek out opportunities in other communities, because there's so many musicians in this town, and there's a limited number of venues. So it's a highly competitive environment. And a lot of these are younger people, and they're trying to make a living at this. And they asked me, I would tell them that that's not a good idea, but they're still doing that, and they need that income and they need those gigs. And so I don't want to be the guy that's taking that money off the table. And I also don't want to be resetting the bar. I'll let things be as they are here, and then I'll go play other places. I don't play out because I need the money. I don't do this for the money. I do it because there's an audience there that I can reach. So I don't do any background music gigs. You know, I play for an audience that's paying attention to the lyrics. And so there's not a whole lot of those anyway. So I do have to kind of have to get on the road a little bit to just to reach those opportunities. But no, I'm not trying to book a tour or anything like that.
I was, so we visited you recently and we were kind of there in Oregon, and you just mentioned going to the coast. Are you talking about someplace on the Oregon coast?
Yeah. We're about 60 miles from the Oregon coast, and there's, what we can call leisure destinations all scattered along the coast there.
Yeah, because we went to Go Beach. I was just wondering if it was around there.
No, it was there's a little town called Yahats, which is an Indian name. It's about 30 miles north of Florence, which is the first spot we hit when we get to the coast. So it's about 90 minutes from here. And I just played there Monday night and had a great night. It's a restaurant and bar, but it's a restaurant and bar that has live music every single night. So anyone who dines there understands the deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
People do come there to enjoy conversation with their companions over dinner, but a lot of people, and there's always at least a couple of tables, no matter what, that are engaged, and I've got someone I can sing to and I can get reactions from and laugh at the jokes, you know? So that's the kind of place I like to play because the very first time I played there last January, a couple from San Francisco, a couple of older guys who were retiring, had built a house up in Waldport, and they're going to have a big housewarming party in August and have invited me to be the entertainment. So sometimes these gigs are just a way to get other gigs.
Is this something you were doing like three decades ago when you and I met in an online community where I didn't realize until maybe a year or so ago that you were a serious musician, because most of our contact had been in a different context.
Right. Well, in that time, you remember a band called Wetware on the Well?
Vaguely. Yeah.
In 1990, we had a fifth anniversary party for the Well at some cowboy bar down south of Market. And we put together a band, and it was Gans and Rick Elswit and myself and Bob Ulius and Flash Gordon and Tex.
Oh, that would have been great. I didn't even know that Flash and Tex were musicians.
Oh yeah, Tex is a good musician. Flash is a pretty good musician. He plays keyboards. The thing is, it sucked. It sucked really hard. It couldn't have sucked harder. It was not a good band. But people seemed to enjoy it anyway. But then out of that, I was then in a band with Elswit called Faraday Cage, Barry Seymour and Cyrus Azar. And then that broke up right around the time I got married in 92. I had David was there, and the members of Faraday Cage were there, and we all played together at my wedding. It was cheaper than hiring a band. And then Faraday Cage broke up over creative differences about the same time that David's band, Crazy Fingers, lost its rhythm section. And so Cyrus and Rick and I joined Crazy Fingers and played with him through 1993. So, and I was, at that time, I was really into a jazz bag, as singing as a vocalist. I wasn't even playing jazz on the guitar. I didn't think I was good enough to try and play jazz on the guitar. And I was playing out with, I don't know if you remember Ned Boynton, N-Boy on the Well.
Yeah.
But he had some gigs, and his then wife, Lorna Kay, had some gigs, and I would sit in on those. And then I actually subbed for Lorna on some of her gigs. And I was playing out as a guy named Tony Agita, singing standards, singing Sinatra songs. And so that was kind of what I was doing 30 years ago.
Wow, that's crazy. I had no idea any of that was going on. I knew about Crazy Fingers. I didn't know that you were part of Crazy Fingers, but Gans had sent me a cassette tape at one point about that he had done. I was impressed. Of course, I had no way to see the band live at the time, except by, flying out. So the one person that I knew was playing music. Well, I knew that Rick Elswit was playing music too, and I knew that he had been with Dr. Hook back when they were on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we had some ringers.
yeah. Well, that's great.
I was doing bass in those, and most of my ensemble work has been on bass.
Were you a Deadhead?
Oh, I've always been a Deadhead. I mean,
okay.
A big part of my life was spent living in my school bus, following the Dead around, selling acid to school kids, and beguiling maidens with the broken seals of perjury. You know, just being that hippie hero on the landscape guy.
Is that how you came to the Well as a Deadhead?
Exactly. Precisely. When my first marriage was to one of those twirler chicks, right? I met her at Red Rocks. And when that broke up, one of her friends offered to sell me his computer. He was moving and needed to get rid of some stuff. And I needed a computer. This would have been 1988. And it was a 286, monochrome monitor thing. And he had been on the Well, and he says, "Oh, you got to try out the Well because there's this conference about the Grateful Dead, and it's hosted by David Gans." And I had met David years before. I'd already auditioned for a band he was putting together in '81, and I didn't make the cut, but I knew who he was, and I'd read his stuff in BAM magazine and so forth. So I was like, "Well, that sounds interesting." And it was already he already had the modem set up to call the Well, so I dialed into the Well on May 6th of 1988 and went straight to the GD conference and got involved with all those guys. And that was how I came to the Well. And it's still an important part of my life. I'm not a big fan of Dead & Company, Dead & Corporation, as I call them. They're doing some good stuff. But I'm kind of over big venue shows, too much security theater.
Yeah, me too.
And it's not just that I don't like the security theater. I don't like the reasons why we have to have it. Right?
Problem with the big shows is they're all basically owned by Live Nation now. I mean, they own all the venues. They own all the tours. So it's basically they become the AT&T of music, I guess.
Yeah, they're the new robber barons that have found a new model for screwing musicians. So that's their big innovation.
And it's really kind of crazy. So now they live stream big events like Coachella and Lollapalooza, and we usually watch those live streams. And I'm just amazed at how elaborate those shows are now. Even the smaller, players get this elaborate visual treatment, and you'll get somebody out there who's just a DJ, a one person act, and they'll have this incredible array of visuals and maybe some auxiliary instrumentation and so forth. I mean, I guess it's great theater. A little mind boggling.
We went to see Green Sky Bluegrass for my birthday here in Eugene at the McDonald Theater, which is owned by Kesey Enterprises, right? And I had to go back to my car three times because they kept finding stuff that they weren't going to let me in with. And I'm like, I thought, really? I can't bring a vape pen in? Are you kidding me? So anyway, and it was weird. I've heard these guys. I heard them at Strawberry a couple of years before. They're really good. But the the sound was engineered for like a hip hop show. So the guy's playing an upright bass and he's going thub, 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 thub. You can't really make out any of the intonation. It's just this throb, this low frequency throb. And the light show was just abusive. You know, they had these, the lights, they would shine them up into the audience, which must be a really nice effect on video, but it was blinding. And it was just, it was not enjoyable. And that was the night I said, you know what? I'm done with shows over 600 capacity.
Yeah, the people that do lighting are all now actually doing video because they line the stages with these big LCD screens or LED screens that are just all networked together and run by computer. And there's very little old school lighting because I early on, you know, was a lighting designer for a couple of bands and it was a lot of fun, but it became just so high tech and so abusive, really. I mean, just like, I think a lot of it came from the production values of all the big hip hop shows. And so mm-hmm. everybody else had to stay up with that. And that's just kind of the way it goes now. It just overkill until you just can't take it anymore.
And I guess the target demographic just eats that up. I'm not in that demographic anymore. I'm turning 70 this year. And I've never cared for hip hop. I respect it as an art form, but it just doesn't reach me on any kind of level. And all the stuff that sort of followed the fashion and the, you know, like you said, the lighting design and the way they mix the audio, it's like a physical assault. And I guess the kids just can't get enough of it because they were having a good time.
It impresses me. There's a lot of EDM in there, you know, which is basically DJ sets. And man, those guys have got elaborate equipment now. You really do have to have some level of, I guess it's mostly a technical skill to be a really good DJ. Maybe I'll do that someday because I sure can't play anything else.
I don't know. I don't think playing records is a talent, but.
Well, I don't know. There's probably more to it than that. I was tempted to say that they're just pushing buttons, but I can't imagine that that's all there is to it.
Yeah. There's a lot of pre-production that goes into those elaborate sets. Yeah. It's not all just by their little finger motions. There's a lot of stuff that's already been programmed in that they just hit a button and it plays itself. They're kind of there for their visuals.
Well, and you know, and that's the thing that happens a lot with the, you know, the really big shows, you know, the, I guess this was back during the, about 20 years ago or so, but they were using Cubase to basically pre-record the entire program, all the vocals, all the instruments, and all of the MIDI triggers for all of the synths, so that when the singer was dancing and couldn't breathe enough air to sing, it would automatically cut over to the recorded vocal until the noise gate picked up more vocal coming from her mic.
I wondered about that. So that's how it works. That's very interesting.
And it's all, you know, all the drums are digital. Everything's all connected to this mastermind. Of course, I use Cubase in my studio. It was a really nice program, but I just used it for recording and mixing records.
We're down to maybe our last 10 minutes or so. So you want to get a couple more tunes in?
Yeah, let me do a couple of songs here. This is a song. This is not about recovery at all. This is a song about a real person who lives down in New Mexico. I had started fooling around with these changes. And these are Jimmy Rogers changes. If I get a hit with this, I'm going to owe the estate of Jimmy Rogers a pound of weed. And so I wanted to write a song about cowboying or railroading. And I don't know much about either one, but my friend Sheridan in New Mexico works as a freelance livestock management generalist and is living on a 6,000 acre ranch down in New Mexico. And I was stealing little details. Sheridan writes on Facebook, I was stealing little details to try and write this first person cowboy song, and it wasn't coming through at all. It wasn't authentic. And that's when I realized this is really her song. and rewrote it to suit. And it's a she's a 21st century cowgirl on her own, not in that rodeo way. For $1.50 a day, her mules and hay, she'll ride all day and she'll sleep where she may. Her steed is a trusty four-wheeler, her airstream's her bunkhouse today. Her GPS tells her she's home on the range where the deer and the antelope play. A 38 special that rides on her hip is no good for moose or for bear, but the rounders all know it ain't there for show, and none of them dare to find out why it's there. Such men as she needs are like hired hands. She works them hard and sends them on their way. She's a 21st century cowgirl, young Leo. A bull elk bugles, an elk harem sings, the Milky Way shimmers, she lives for these things. She'd rather sleep with coyotes and snakes and some wealthy fine gentleman and all that he makes. Her life is her own, so don't you judge her. You're in no position to say she's a 21st century cowgirl. Yippee-yi, yippee-yo, yippee-yay. Now if the life that we're living is forgiven, and death's just the end of the trade, well, then it isn't that strange that she's at home on the range. She works hard all day and she draws equal pay. She's a 21st century cowgirl in her own 19th century way. She fixes her eyes on beyond the horizon, and the skies are not cloudy all day. She's a 21st century cowgirl. Ooh, where the deer and the antelope play.
Nice.
All right.
It used to go over pretty good. And then this isn't so much about recovery. This is the one that I wrote all the words to in one sitting, and then I didn't write the music for another few months. And when I finished the lyrics, the next day I learned that a friend of mine had died of a heart attack while I was writing those lyrics. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. And then months later, when I had that breakthrough with the changes, and I got it all written down, and I said, okay, it's set. And I went online to kind of boast about that. And that's when I learned that John Barlow had died. And a fellow songwriter with a lot more success than I've had. And it makes you kind of wonder sometimes, maybe if you're not riding with number three, but it's not about those guys. It's not, but it is about a physical, metaphysical, metaphorical mythical, mystical, infinite point in time and space, equidistant between grief and grace. And it's kind of my status report on my sobriety, but you sort of have to read between the lines. Sometimes we spar, sometimes we spoon, a couple times we've even kissed. It's a delicate negotiation, let me go. Meet face to face in that narrow space where blue and violet confide. It's just a few cycles of spectrum with a visual Doppler effect. There's no way of knowing if you're coming or going, and it's later than you respect. Electrons charge gases in an instant, photons divide to enlighten the sky, delighting the eye where blue and violet confide. Sit for silence, we pray for peace like a terrier after a rat. Stoke despair with desire, where there's smoke, there's fire, where it's even simpler than that. The Sutra of Loss isn't surprise that something beloved has died. That koan lies and final goodbyes where you and violet confide. So I guess you could say I'm doing okay, as long as you grade on the curve and not by the measure of the trash or treasure or even what I deserve. There's a chewy, creamy
center sublime. It's there for the seeking inside. Just drifting and dreaming, three-quarter time, where blue and violet. Just drifting and dreaming in three-quarter time, where blue and violet confine.
Wow. Thanks so much.
You bet.
That's fantastic. We are out of time. This has been great. I hope you'll come back and do it again sometime.
I got a million of them.
Excellent. Well, thanks. Thanks.
Thanks. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. Always, okay. Always love to show up and show the flag.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.